Good morning.
Good morning.
I presume we should start. All is well at Holden Village. Seems good for me. Hope it is for you. Where are we? Overall, what I'm doing here, especially if you haven't been here before, is looking at the material from Isaiah in the midst of or immediately after the exile that tries to make sense of what has happened, make sense of God, redefine, recreate faith in a situation where literally everything has been broken. And so what is it going to take to make a new theological beginning speaking somewhat stupidly, to reinvent God even in that situation where it appears to be the case that everything God has been up to has been broken, which of course will call God into question as well. So that's the overall agenda for these sessions. Yesterday, we looked at the first servant song with a interesting "He Will Not" sections, where it seems as though through the servant of God in the second part of the book, especially this, as we said, he will not, a dimly burning wick, he will not quench, which is a direct reference in the book itself to what God did in the Exodus, quenching Pharaoh's wick, blah, blah, which God will not apparently, or at least the servant now apparently, will not do as he brings forth justice to the nations, justice and teaching, where teaching, I'm writing sideways now, where teaching is Torah, God's Torah, God's instruction, God's revelation to the nations, gonna do all that, gonna do it in somewhat of a different way without quenching the dimly burning wick. What will that look like? How do you get there from here? That's the ongoing question. It's one of the tensions in the second part of the book of Isaiah. It's a dialectical tension that will remain in some sense forever in biblical theology, and perhaps must, between God's work of power and God's work of compassion. Here we set up this possibility of doing an Exodus kind of thing without blah, blah. What will that look like? The one beginning at a resolution of that tension comes a few chapters later, when we get this great text, as I was saying the other day, Dietrich Bonhoeffer said, speaking to myself now, one should never say this is a great text. It's not up to you to say what are great texts and what aren't. They're all great texts. Anyway, it is an interesting text. I don't know if that's legal, but the structure, listen. Shema in Hebrew, right? Listen. Powerful voices calling Israel to listen in this threefold poetic, three stanza poetic oracle. It's interesting all the way around, but in the middle of that, the second one, the middle stanza, listen to me, my people, listen to me, my people. Who's speaking? That's fairly clear, right? Listen to me, my people, give heed to me, my nation, And for a teaching will go out from me, my justice for a light to the peoples. I will bring near my deliverance swiftly. My salvation is gone out. My arms will rule the peoples. The coastlands wait for me, and for my arm they hope. I should have left the other text up there longer, perhaps this morning. We looked at it. Any ring any bells here? We need a split screen. My justice will go out to the nations. I will bring near my deliverance. The coastlands wait for me. Here's the servant. The coastlands wait for his teaching at the bottom. He will not faintly establish justice in the earth. That is, here's the servant. Here goes his teaching, his justice for the nations. A few chapters later, here's God. The coastlands wait for me, for my teaching, whatever, justice teaching. That is to say, who speaks in 42?
Isaiah.
Well, the servant. It speaks of, or at least it speaks third person of the servant. Who speaks here?
God.
That is to say, precisely the same mission that is described in the servant song of 42 is here put by God in the hands of God. The servant's mission is God's mission. Okay, the servant is going to be about this business, and as we see throughout the text, we'll see the next one this morning, is about this business of being a light to the nations. Here, very directly, can't miss this, same language, same words, the work of the servant becomes the work of God. There are many volumes written about who is the servant in Isaiah. It has been debated, lo, these many years, often stupidly, but that's another issue. Here's the answer. Yeah, well, it's not a... I'll go back to my poetic observation of a couple of days ago. It's not an equation to be solved. It's poetry to be experienced. But at any rate, at this level, who's the servant? Well, surely in this text, it is God who takes upon God's self the work of the servant. That's interesting, especially when the servant starts to get knocked over the head for this, and worse. What does it mean that God, already here in Isaiah, is taking on the role and the work of the servant? Sorry, upstairs. Can you hear me when I'm standing back there?
Yep.
Okay.
God whispered.
Thank you. You know this. That was my wife.
Yeah.
Or was it not? You said, well, never mind.
I said it, but now it's like, my voice.
Oh, okay, sorry. I screwed up all around. God as servant. I looked last week, for those, if anybody's still in the room, at the "With whom will you compare me" texts in Isaiah, asking the question of who is comparable to God. And at one level, as long as one looks up, which is the immediate point of those texts, the answer is clearly nobody. That is to say, no other power in heaven than God, no other God than God. I am the Lord, there is no other. That recurring refrain in the second part of Isaiah. Nobody home there other than me. Nobody. On the other hand, the wonderful way in this book with which God will compare God to anything and anybody in the creation. And, you know, God is mother, God is father in this material. God is shepherd, God is warrior, God is leopard, lion, God is lamb. I mean, it's all over the place, the things with which God will compare God in the creation as metaphor in order to help God's people understand God. Well, here's another one that usually doesn't get in the list because people are a little leery of this one in Isaiah. God as the servant. God taking on the servant role, which does seem to me to be what's going on in this passage. Well, that's one beginning step toward the resolution of this question of how is God going to pull off this doing of the Exodus without the dead Egyptians on the shore, which is, as we said yesterday, has been something of a theological moral dilemma for Israel all along. As, of course, it continues to be, and can't, I mean, the tension in some sense is inherent. If God's going to mess around in history, God's going to get God's hands dirty because he can't not. And, I mean, that is the offense of incarnation. In some sense, it's an inherent offense of the gospel. It's one of the reasons, you know, a lot of people are going to say, that's why I don't like that book. I want a God hands off God. Then God could keep clean. God won't keep clean in incarnation, and it's an inherent tension in an incarnational theology because it's going to give offense. That is the offense of the gospel. Here it is too, in these passages where the offense is going to be God's trying to mess around in history, and yet keep a gentle hand. Can you do that? Not always, maybe, sometimes. I mean, that's the issue, or that's the tension that's built into this second half of the book of Isaiah, perhaps most very strongly there, though certainly not limited to that material in biblical theology. Okay, God now, taking upon God the some of the same work that is described of the servant in chapter 42. There's another servant introduction a few chapters later, after 42, and these will be, for those of you who have done this before, the well-known four servant songs of 2nd Isaiah. As I said yesterday, we hear them every year at Christmas and at Advent and Lent, and so they're instantly about Jesus. And there's something right about that, but there is also something dangerously wrong about it because we don't hear them then in their historical biblical context, and they're about Jesus before we ever knew what they were about. And so therefore we don't know what Jesus is about because we don't know what these were about. You got to go there first before you go to the other one in order to amplify what the heck they're saying when they're picked up in the New Testament to talk about Jesus. They're about Jesus, but if it's just a cipher that's about Jesus, it doesn't help us a lot. What is about Jesus? And in order to see the what, you have to see these texts in their Old Testament sense, in their setting in the book, which means you can't really just rip out four servant songs and read them independently, as though somehow they don't have anything to do with anything. It would be like ripping a chapter out of any book and assuming you can understand it without knowing what it is in context. You don't read anything that way. Why in the world would you read the Bible that way? But anyway, I mean, people have identified these texts in which we get the servant commissioned for particular work. Now, the first thing you have to recognize, that if you do ask the question of who is the servant, is there are all kinds of texts in the latter part of Isaiah that talk about the servant, and it's always Israel. What is different about these four that have gotten picked up is in the other ones, Israel, my servant, Israel, my beloved, Israel, my chosen, is the recipient of divine grace. Fear not, my servant Israel, I am with you, I will care for you. I mean, it's that language. In these four, the difference is, look, servant, here's a job to do. That is, the servant is commissioned for particular work. That is different in these four. On the other hand, we certainly cannot rip them out of context and say that all of that other servant stuff identifying Israel as the servant is irrelevant when we look at this servant. And in order to make sure you can't regard it as irrelevant, for those who don't want the servant to be Israel, there's this pretty nasty little, wherever it is in here. Find the Israel
three,
word for me.
Three.
I can't read because it's too bright. There's a metaphor in there somewhere. God says to me, you are my servant Israel. Well, duh. I mean, doesn't that pretty well identify the servant? Well, of course, those who don't want it to be Israel can. In fact, they can find a manuscript in which the Israel doesn't occur. Clearly the servant is Israel. Is the servant other than Israel? Is the servant more than Israel? Is the servant something else? I mean, that's part that the wonderful thing about poetry is it can be ambiguous. As I said yesterday with that you in chapter 42, who is that you? Well, it doesn't say. So be there if you want. Who's the servant? It's way too, to solve that equation is going to be way too neat. Is the servant Israel? Absolutely. Is the servant other than Israel? Good question. Or more than Israel? We got to continue to talk about that one. Here comes this text with a new commission, a new introduction, where now the servant speaks. In yesterday's text, God spoke, right? Here is my servant. Now the servant speaks. Listen to me, O coastlands. Pay attention, you peoples from far away. The Lord called me before I was born. While I was in my mother's womb, he named me. He made my mouth like a sharp sword. In the shadow of his hand, he hid me. He made me a polished arrow, and in his quiver hid me away. And he said, you are my servant, Israel, in whom I will be glorified. Go away from Isaiah. Just think reading the Bible in general. If you read this text, what is this? Who's talking? What kind of a text is this? The Lord has called me from the womb. He's made my mouth like a sharp sword. What role is this?
Is it a call narrative?
It's a prophetic call narrative. I mean, if it were outside of this thing, if we hadn't get all caught up in the question of who is the servant of God in Isaiah, we would have no question about that. It's a prophetic call narrative. It's just like all the other prophetic call narratives. Just like Jeremiah, the Lord called me in the womb. I mean, it's the same language as the call narrative of Jeremiah. And of course, as in all call narratives, the first response of the prophet is, not me, in one way or the other. Jeremiah says, I'm too young. And God says, go anyway. Here, what God says is, or what the prophet says is, I already tried. I've labored in vain. I have spent my strength for nothing in vanity. That is to say, this is a second call narrative. I had a first call. It didn't work. So what the heck am I supposed to do now? Well, go see the bishops again. Yeah. The first call really screwed. I mean, I labored in vain. It didn't work. I'm in despair here. Pastoral burnout. So God says, who formed me in the womb, by the way, back to that. So, okay, the first call didn't work. Why not? Well, God says, it's too light a thing that you should be my servant to raise up the tribes of Jacob and to restore the survivors of Israel. I'll give you as a light to the nations. Why? that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. You know, I had this call in western North Dakota where everybody in sight was a Lutheran, and that didn't work. Okay, well, try Baghdad. Why did I ask for a new call? Who needs this? But that is precisely the rhetoric, that's precisely the outline, that's precisely the argument, that's precisely the flow of this text. Here comes this prophet servant looking for a new call, and not looking for a new call. God's looking for a new call. He says, no, it doesn't work. God says, that's something bigger in store for you. Light to the nations, salvation to the ends of the earth. Again, naive reader of the book. Just, we didn't know there was a problem here. I'm a naive reader of the book. Somebody gets up in the book and says, listen to me, O coastlands. The Lord called me before I was born. Naive reader of the book. Who's speaking? Well, but I mean, if you're a naive reader, what do you assume? Yeah, I mean, me, I'm writing a book. the naive reading of the book has to say this is Isaiah. Now, naive readings aren't always right, but it sort of has to be your first choice of what might be going on here. And I think that's right. And then the next servant song, which I'm not going to look at in detail because we don't have enough days, but the next one is going to say, whatever it's going to say, in chapter 50, same kind of thing. Here's me again. The Lord God has given me the tongue of a teacher that I may know how to sustain the weary with a word. It's a prophet again. It's Luther, you know, the pastoral office is a mouth house. Here's the mouth house guy talking again. The naive reader has to say, looks like Isaiah to me. And so once again, I don't want to say that that's the solution to the servant problem. No, it's not Israel. No, it's not Jesus. It's Isaiah. It's way more interesting than that. That is to say, the agency is complex and manifold, as it was in that you yesterday. Is that Cyrus? Yeah. Is that the servant? Yeah. Is that Israel? Yeah. Is that the prophet? Yeah. Everybody's in that you in the book. That is called to, in that chapter, bring liberty to the captives, etc. Jesus thought that was a pretty good idea, pretty good sermon, but it's all over the place already in the Old Testament mission to God's people, and anybody who's in God's people can read that and put themselves in that you. And here, I mean, I think it's impossible to read this without seeing that at least in some degree, the servant talk in the book of Isaiah is autobiographical. It's not only autobiographical, but it is certainly in part autobiographical. Which means now we get, not unlike Paul, the autobiographical experience of suffering is what gives rise to some interesting theology of suffering. So for Paul, in 2 Corinthians, the autobiographical experience of the thorn of the flesh is, in Paul's own testimony, pretty much what gives birth to the whole theology of the cross. Oh, now I get it, that God's weakness, God's glory is made perfect in weakness. God's power is made perfect in weakness. Now I get it, because I understand the weakness all of a sudden. Things were going pretty well for me, and I didn't get it. Now I do. Here's the servant who is trying to preach the word here, and nothing's working. And then later on in chapter 50, in the next one, he's going to be much more direct. I turned my cheeks to those who pulled out the beard. I always worry about that one. I did not hide my face from insult and spitting. That is, the prophet experiences the negative reaction that true prophets always get from the people of God. And it gives some indication of what suffering is about, and then will develop, stay tuned tomorrow, to a theology of suffering that is remarkably new in biblical theology. This guy comes to say, comfort, comfort my people. I mean, I can understand a prophet that comes to say, I hate your solemn assemblies, getting knocked over the head by the people and fired from his call. But this is a guy, or hers, this is a prophet who comes to say, comfort, comfort my people. What are you going to fire that one for? Well, you know, people of God can find reason to fire any pastor, but what are you going to fire this one for? The one who comes to preach comfort to the people of Israel. Any ideas? There's no simple answer to this question, but any idea? I mean, here's a people in exile. As I said the other day, don't think Auschwitz, but think Warsaw Ghetto. A ghettoized people taken away from a homeland in ruins. Here's a prophet says, comfort, comfort my people, because God's making a new Exodus and we can go home.
Don't raise my hopes.
That's one of them. You know, I tried this. I don't believe it. You don't believe it. I don't either. that's certainly one of them. Dare I possibly believe this?
These people are feeling abandoned by God.
Right.
Just let them down. Why should? What's this business about comfort? You
want? Yeah. From whom? Yeah. Right. That's one of them.
You might not be so great on that light to the Gentile nations.
Yeah, right. That's another problem. Jonah figured that one out. We don't want to go there. They're not only are they, you know, uncircumcised heathen, but they're the guys who put us in jail. I mean, they're the guys who ruined the homeland.
It seems like the comfort that he was offering wasn't the kind that they were expecting or that they desired.
Okay. It's certainly in general, we would much rather have tanks than no blah blah in this.
But at least I have food here.
That's what they said the last time around, right? You read the book. Exactly. I mean, that's a big Arabian desert out there. Sure, water in the desert. Show me. It ain't great, but we're eating. That's another one.
Surely somebody can do better than this.
I'm sorry?
Surely somebody can do better than this guy.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of reasons why, besides which, go home, there's no home there. To go home means to have to rebuild everything. There's nothing there, according to Jeremiah or Lamentations, well, that's Jeremiah too. It is a house of jackals. That's what's there now, yes.
They might prefer a revenge to comfort.
It would be good. A little revenge always tastes good. So a lot of reasons they might not be terribly excited about a prophet who is saying, go home, urging them to go home, that the will of God is for them to go home. Among them, you know, it's possible that we're fairly well established here. And in fact, they will become fairly well established there and invent. Most of them do not ever go home. Most of them do not ever go home. And they invent a diaspora Judaism in Babylon that lives forever. You know, sad Saddam tried to take care of it, but there's still some there. And you know, I got a kosher deli on the corner of 3rd and Marduk. Why should I go home? In some sense, this is the same argument that this is the same resistance you might get, and I don't mean this with any pejorative sense at all, but it's the same resistance you might get in New York City among prosperous Jewish folks telling them they ought to go to Israel, because that's their home.
So are you saying this stuff was written early exile?
It's in the midst.
It's in the midst.
In the midst.
So some are at this point of, I don't want to go home,
yeah,
while others are still longing for home.
Exactly. Everybody pretty much agrees. I mean, there is clearly prophecy or looking back that's written after the fact and influenced by the fact. Everybody pretty much agrees, even the radical skeptics, that this stuff is written in the midst. So, go home. Yeah, easy for you to say, chop chop. And I mean, that's what the prophet now experiences, and it is that experience that this is going to give some rise to whatever it is that this suffering servant theology out of this book is going to, however that's going to develop. And once again, if we're going to jump to Jesus as the suffering servant, just to be clear, the New Testament never does. That is, it never uses that language. Latter Christian interpretation uses that language. The New Testament never does. Neither does the Old, for that matter. It's an invented term. But if we're going to go to, you know, Jesus as the suffering servant of God, it will help to know why that might happen, the suffering of the servant for the sake of fidelity to the word, by looking at the prophetic material in its native habitat, that is, in its original setting, in order to see what's going on there. So here we are with this servant, now servant, prophet, Israel, you name it, all in one, who is called to, finally now, as we have seen, be a light to the nations that my salvation may reach to the end of the earth. Obviously, that's a radical line, for heaven's sakes. I thought we were just us. But what if we're not us anymore? Wrote that editorial in Word and World several years ago. What happens when you allow in a little bit of diversity is pretty soon you're not us anymore, and that's hard. Is that good news or is that bad news? What if we're not us anymore? These folks weren't at all certain we're not us anymore, especially when the us that they're trying to be is really, I mean, we're holding this thing together with scotch tape and clarinet reeds, right? And you want us now. You want us now to be light to the nations? We ain't got, I mean, we're the dimly burning wick here. We barely got light for ourselves. What's that mean? How can that possibly mean anything at all to this struggling folk in this situation? That's what we hear. Where's this going to go in terms of that resolution that I was talking about yesterday, or that the text is talking about, the resolution of the tension that I was talking about, namely, on the one hand, the work of God through Cyrus to crunch them Babylonian bastards, excuse the language, but it seems appropriate, and to do the revenge thing, or if not revenge, at least, I mean, one could put the best construction on it. This is not just the conqueror of Israel. This is the bad guys who are the oppressive despots of the whole known world. Come on, get them out of here. And if Cyrus is going to do that and let not just Israelite exiles go home, but all kinds of foreign exiles go home. This is a good thing. We would applaud this. And so that's, on the one hand, the work that God is doing in this book through Cyrus, who surprisingly gets named God's Messiah and God's servant, and not servant, shepherd, maybe servant somewhere, God's shepherd, God's Messiah. People don't like that either, but God's at work in this guy. God doesn't like tyrants and despots and exile walls, and God just doesn't like that. And God's at work. On the other hand, Israel, God, as we saw yesterday in the flood, sees the problem that, you know, one way to fix it is to kill everybody, and that really doesn't quite do what God wants to do either. And so now what are we going to do? How are we going to resolve that? Here's an interesting, there's an interesting turn in the book at this point. That is, here's the me who gets up and says, listen to me, O coastlands, pay attention, you peoples from far away. The Lord called me before I was born. That me is first introduced, is first introduced a few verses earlier. In chapter 48, a few verses earlier than chapter 49 is frequently in chapter 48. Whatever book you're in. Anyway, so here's chapter 48, a long and very complex chapter. This is one about which, the structure of which, there is absolutely no agreement among scholars. So I always give it to my students to say, you know, figure out this text and hope that somebody might, then I could publish. But it's certainly one thing that's going on in the poetic structure. We've learned a little bit about poetic structure, of how things tie together in poetic structure. Here, poetic structure is going to tell us, among whatever else is going on here, here's a section. Whoops. How do we know here's a section? Well, assemble, draw near. We've got an inclusio imperative around this little section, around this little stanza of poetry here. Assemble, all of you, draw near, hear this. Dissemble and hear, draw near, hear this. Beginning, end, what's in the middle? The Lord loves him, who's him. He shall perform his purpose on Babylon. His arm shall be against the Chaldeans. Okay, gotta be Cyrus. This one's gotta be Cyrus. It doesn't say, but it's gotta be Cyrus. The him who is gonna conquer the Babylonians. The Lord loves him, that's nice. He shall perform his purpose. Welcome back to purpose tomorrow. That's an important word in this book. Stay tuned. His arm shall be against the Chaldeans. I have spoken and called him. I have brought him. He will prosper in his way. Draw near and hear this. Cyrus. And then this little strange out of place voice that says, and hard to figure out what this is doing in the book, and now the Lord God has sent me and his spirit. Who's me? At that point in the book, we have absolutely no idea. Until, you know, you get down a few verses, and then chapter 49 starts. Listen to me, O coastlands. Pay attention, you peoples. The Lord has called me before I was born, and we get this introduction to the second servant song.
Fred, are you suggesting then that this section about the guy who's going to scatter the Chaldeans is probably a later insertion?
Well, everything's a later insertion in tense. I can't see who was talking.
That's me.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, I'm hidden by the light.
Everything's a later insertion in terms of the actual construction of the book.
Okay. But after the events, like you
said. Well, I mean, I don't know whether this is after the events. This is in the midst of the argument. I mean, the book is put together, of course, after the events. But this is in the middle of the argument. there is an argument in the book that it's not merely random oracles, random sermons. It's complex, and it's not just a straight line argument. It goes all over the place. And one of the brilliant parts of the argument of the book is this sort of random moving back and forth between Cyrus and servant. That is the powerful work of God in Cyrus, the gentle work of God in the servant. And if you could just get that all, you know, give it to me, I'm an editor, I could fix this and make it all come out right. It resists fixing. And we just think we've got it figured out, and God's going to do the crunching thing, and here comes a servant text. Okay, now we got that figured out, and here comes another power text. It's interestingly complex. But what happens in that argument here is, given all of this ups and downs and back and forth, here assemble, God loves Cyrus, and God's going to accomplish God's purpose through Cyrus. This is, in fact, the last time we meet Cyrus in the book. The argument of the book here, the flow of the book here is, I think, significant. We never meet Cyrus again in the book. After this little squeaky voice says, "If that man has sent me," doesn't have to be a squeaky voice. After this voice gets up and says, "And now God has sent me," we never meet Cyrus again. That's interesting in the flow of the book, the argument of the book, the theology of the book. We never meet Cyrus again. And then we find out that "me" is the servant. That's kind of interesting. Up until now, we've had the mix, Cyrus servant, Cyrus servant, Cyrus servant. Now we get a final Cyrus text, "And now God has sent me," and now we never meet Cyrus again. I don't want to make this neater than I should either. That is to say, okay, it's all resolved now, God's going to be nice. The Old Testament is the book of God before he got religion. Not that. Not a cartoon on my door that I use on and off with the guy coming into the CEO's receptionist, the corporate executive's receptionist, and asks, it's God's receptionist, it's God as CEO, and the question of the guy coming into the office, is he the God of the Old Testament this morning or the God of the New Testament? Well, that's wrong, of course, as though there is only wrath in the Old Testament and only love in the New Testament. Both things are wrong. It becomes a stereotypical truism for us, as though it's true. It's not. But it's not this neat. We're not fixing it here. God here becomes nice. On the other hand, it is not insignificant that we never meet Cyrus. I mean, we're going to have judgment texts after this. Of course we are. But it's not insignificant that we never meet Cyrus again. And now we meet the servant, more full-blown, in the servant's own voice. And we're going to see where that servant stuff is going to go as the book develops. Paul?
Do you think on some levels the community is wrestling with both their hopes through Cyrus and then their ultimate disappointment in what Cyrus can do for them?
Perhaps. I mean, Cyrus is pretty good for a captive Haman, because he does in fact let these folks go. He does in fact give a royal subsidy to rebuild their temple, and he does that not just for Israel. He doesn't care about Israel.
Well, maybe
but he does it for everybody.
Maybe the disappointment isn't just with Cyrus, but with himself.
Yeah.
In light of all of that, yeah. Many of them decide not to go home.
Part of that, certainly. And part of all of that, can we believe this? It hasn't happened yet at this point in the book. And at this point in the history of the writing, it hasn't happened yet. We don't know which. But clearly, I mean, the hope of the text, poetry or just poetry, mere poetry, or wonderful poetry, who knows? But in the Cyrus Oracle, what we look, God says to the Cyrus, God says to Cyrus that you will know that I am the Lord. Does Cyrus ever come to know that? Yeah, who knows? I mean, there's no historical record. Cyrus, we don't have a record of Cyrus's conversion. And I doubt if there was one. So it's overblown. The poetry, the rhetoric is overblown. It's not a bad thing. It doesn't mean it's not true. But some of the hopes of Cyrus are never going to be fulfilled. And yet at the same time, this work of God through the gentle servant is going to be surprised, and we're not sure we want that. So that tension continues throughout the remainder of the book. And life? Maybe. Yeah. I'll close this out and then have a few more minutes for discussion. The tension isn't going to go away. This is, I think, nevertheless, a significant, if temporal, resolution to the tension in the book. But even in the book, the tension isn't going to go away, because in fact, I think theologically, it cannot. God of power, God of love, it's still in our prayers. And the tension won't go away because it probably can't. The resolution, it's really important to understand that the resolution of that tension, that somebody said that yesterday, stole my thunder. The resolution of that tension in the Bible, the tension between the wrath of God, the grace of God, the hard work of God, the gentle work of God, the tension in the Bible, always, every text, I've never found one that this is not true, look if you can, is always resolved in favor of grace, in favor of mercy. Mercy is who God is in the Bible. The hard work is sometimes what God does in order to get toward the work of mercy that God is love. It would be impossible in biblical theology to have a sentence, God is wrath. That would be another religion. God is love, and the wrath of God everywhere, in every single text in the Bible, the wrath of God is in service of the love of God. That is to say, the wrath of God is God's temporal work to get folks out of the way, if necessary, in order to get at the love of God. So, I mean, if in fact Babylon, Egypt, name it, has oppressed the people of God so mightily that things are in danger of death all around, God might do something hard in order to get folks out of that situation. As I have sometimes said, using the parental image, and I did this last week for those of you who were here, I think, using the parental image, the parent will do whatever it takes to keep the toddler from wandering into the traffic, including knocking down the kid if that's the only way to stop them. Or including throwing nails in the street to stop the cars. I mean, if you got to do that. That seems to me perhaps the best definition of the wrath of God. God as parent preventing the kid from playing in traffic. And as I sometimes say to students, pretty much all Old Testament law is this: don't play in traffic. It'll kill you. Don't go there. God is not the Puritan who, I think it's Edmund Wilson's definition of Puritanism, people who live with the horrible, haunting fear that somewhere someone is having a good time. Now, that's not true of Puritans either, but they make a good scapegoat. But this is not the God of the Bible. the law of God is to say, keep you alive. It's not that God lives in great fear that you might be playing bingo on Sunday or something. Anyway, the resolution is always, no text that I have ever found in which the resolution is not in favor of grace. So, hard words, for example, in 54, Isaiah 54, for a brief moment I abandoned you. That's pretty awful. Why have you forsaken me, God? Well, maybe again. For a brief moment I abandoned you, but with great compassion I will gather you in overflowing wrath. For a moment I hid my face, but with everlasting love I will have compassion. A moment, everlasting. I mean, that's the way that poetry always works. Moment of wrath, day of wrath, day of the Lord, but everlasting grace, compassion, love. It's always the way the text works. So the resolution will remain. The resolution will always be in favor of compassion. And now this God has come to this prophet to turn the prophet, Israel, the servant, loose to, because it's too light a thing that I only care about Israel. I'm going for the world. See what happens. All right. A few minutes of more of conversation.
I have a question. In light of the other things you said about the text, to what extent is God all-powerful, always in control?
Yeah, I never use the language of control anymore. I don't think it fits for the biblical God. God's in control, then God's a monster.
Yeah.
If God's in control. I understand that God is in control language can be comforting language for some people in some situations, and I don't necessarily want to rob folks of that.
Sorry, leave out the word control. Power.
I hope God still has power. I hope God always has power. You know, you don't want the hind quarter to run out in the winter. You want God, a God of power. The question is not whether there is power. The question is what you do with it. How one exercises it. As I said the other day, whenever that was. The immovable omni God is not the God of the Bible. Philosophical theology invents the impassible God, the untouchable God, the unfeeling God, the God who is beyond all human pain and suffering. Jesus isn't, but I mean, they can deal with that. But God. Is protected from all. Because this is, Greek gods have to be a full-blown, self-respecting god. Well, it's not stupid. They're not doing stupid stuff. They're trying to talk theology in the world in which they live. Everybody has to do that. Next generation may always say that's stupid, but it's the best you can do. It's what we all do. Try to talk theology to and in the context of the worldview in which we live. And people in the Greek worldview pretty much invented the god of the philosophers, the omni-god. This is where I said, as Pascal says, it's a Greek god. It's just not the god of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who is much more touchable, much more involved, much more incarnational, and in wonderfully ways, much more playful in the description of God and God in the Bible. Is this God always and forever Emmanuel with us, a active, doing surprising things in that sense? Power, presence, yes. Not in control, I would say, in my opinion, in the sense, never in biblical theology. If it happens, God did it. The reality is much more complex than that. Agency is much more complex than that. Agency in the world as God has made it, because that's the way God made it, is much more complex than that.
Question.
Yes.
When you're looking at, I have to admit, I'm a little bit confused normal.
Join the crowd.
We were talking about the gentle servant. You know, it says the servant is Israel.
Yeah.
But the servant may also be a person.
Yeah.
Okay, because...
We'll fix this tomorrow. No, we won't, but I mean, we will talk about this tomorrow.
Okay, because in that latter part of the text when he says, basically, you know, why do I want to do this? Because I failed.
Yeah.
So Israel failed with itself, so it should go out.
Yeah, I mean, you can do it either way. The reason that the tradition in general has favored some kind of individual identity of the servant is because the text becomes so individual in their description of what, it's just like a person. At the same time, the bad news is that these texts have been among the most divisive between Christian and Jewish interpreters. Because Jews, of course, want to say, of course it's Israel. You want to see a suffering nation? Watch this. Of course it's Israel. And Christians say, of course it's Jesus. And in bad days, that simply is argument rather than dialogue. And there's been a lot of bad days in the interpretation of these texts between Christians and Jews. And so, you know, Jews, now you're stealing our whole identity from us by saying this is Jesus. Christians, on the other hand, say, I can't read this and not see Jesus. I mean, so that can be rich dialogue. It can be pretty bad conversation, too, or lack of conversation. What was your question?
I was confused.
Is it a person?
Yeah.
And, I mean, it is, of course, in poetry. Back to yesterday, is poetry, I mean, it's obviously it's possible in poetry to have a person highly sounding like a person, yet have that be a corporate identity is possible. So one cannot say you can't read the text this way. And most of Israel does, continues to read the text that way. At the same time, other readers, including some Jewish readers, say, gee whiz, that's really individual, really personal. How can that mean? I mean, they are not going to say it's Jesus, but they might say, well, is it Jeremiah? Is it the prophet? Is it Isaiah? I mean, they might do that. The bell hath rung.